Good morning and welcome to the Valley Outdoors. Great to have you with us. Don, he's here.
I'm here.
Ava's here.
I'm here as well.
Yeah, and we're going to have a good day today. Lots of cool stories. One I think a lot of people are going to be interested in. If you're a muskie fisherman, I think you're going to want to hang out. It's research looking at what triggers muskie to bite. That and a lot more when we come back. Eric Olson here, professional walleye tour champion, avid outdoorsman, and host of the Valley Outdoors radio show. Aquatic invasive species, or AIS, threatens not only our rivers and lakes here, but everywhere we boat. They come in many forms, and they love to hitch a ride to the next body of water on your boat or trailer. Join me to stop the spread of AIS by cleaning all weeds and aquatic material from your trailer before leaving the launch ramp. Drain live wells and clean areas that don't drain completely. Plus, don't forget to pull the plug. Clean, drain, dry. Together, we can make a difference. Good morning, you guys.
Morning.
How's things, Ava?
Going good.
Going well. Love it. I love it. You know what? We start looking at what's going on when the winter, still dead of winter, but there's lots of purchasing going on, getting ready for spring. You were talking about that last week.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the sports shows are starting to fire up. I mean,
yeah.
We got a little ways in Minnesota to wait, but I'm sure around the country.
Well, the groundhog did go back.
Yeah.
You know.
It does every year.
Are you sure? Because it is warm here this weekend.
Yeah, which is nice for going out skiing. That's what I'm going to do.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, that's good. But brings us back to electronics. You don't have to buy a new boat to upgrade the electronics. And the more I keep thinking about it, there's so much that's being marketed across the board right now as far as the latest, greatest technology.
Right.
But there is a long way that you can go from what you have as your existing electronics package in your boat, whether you've got a little small screen in the front or you've got minimal technology at the dash. If you're a fisherman and you thought about, well, maybe I should, I'm telling you, there's going to be supply. Number one, that's one of the biggest issues in the past. And there's going to be a myriad of things available and people are going to want to be moving them. And take the time, look at what you want from anything from 17 feet on up. My feeling on those kinds of boats, don't get anything smaller than a size 7 minimum or a 9 for the dash. It allows you to split the screens and utilize the down imaging and the side imaging, which brings me to the next thing. Use and get those technologies. They will transform your fishing. They're not difficult to use. I mean, don't you agree, Don? I mean, it's become so easy.
Yeah.
One of those things you deal with a lot of times is the learning curve. You think, oh, I've got all that stuff on there. Yeah. I can't figure it out.
Take the time to either watch some YouTube videos from the manufacturer, whatever manufacturer you're buying from, and see how these units operate, because it makes it such a huge difference once you realize what you're doing.
Well, and the thing, too, is it's so intuitive now, as opposed to, well, you have to go into this screen, and then you flip through this screen to get to this, and then you push this, then now it's active. Now it's a matter of, like, programming your radio in your car. You push the button down and hold it. Okay, there's your favorite screen. Flip through a bunch of screens. There's my other one. Save that, and then save the next one. Piece of cake.
Right.
Really easy to use. So really, the bottom line is, when you're looking at electronics, there's a lot being marketed. You don't have to go off the charts spending, but get a big enough sized Graph GPS combo. Always go Graph GPS combo. Get the transducer that's appropriate for it, because that's one of the learning curves. You'll find it'll come with the high speed transducer. Most electronics don't come with high speed. They'll come with the basic transducer that's going to operate for the slow speeds. You'll have to add a transducer for high speed so you can drive down the lake and have a reading. And last but not least, most of these have a connection, either a Y cable or something like that, that connect the two. It's that simple. It's not rocket science. You can do it yourself. It's a power cord. You run those up through the gunwale of the boat, bring it to your dash.
I mean, I think part of the key is getting them mounted correctly is all. So, again, watch a YouTube video on it. Mm-hmm. If you don't understand the directions that you receive with it, and they'll explain how it's best done.
Yeah, the easiest. I think one of the biggest errors that I see, even coming from marinas,
right,
is that the somebody that's mounting it is not maybe a fisherman or understanding what happens. Take a straight edge, put it up against the bottom of the boat. Make sure that transducer is only like just about a quarter of an inch, barely higher. Quarter of an inch below the bottom of the boat.
Below.
Just below the bottom of a boat. So you can see that that's going to be down a little bit. And that's on the high speed. The big transducer, that's designed for the slower trolling and the detail. That's up off the bottom of the boat. Right. Do not run that below the bottom of the boat. Those are the two biggest errors that I see when people are mounting electronics. If you've got one for Christmas and you're anxious to get out, just take the time to understand and make sure that you don't put it in line with the main engine.
Right.
We've had situations where people do that. It aerates the propeller. And then what happens? You can't create any lift out of the bow. And you can lose, this is no lie, 5 miles an hour.
From your transducer? 5 miles an hour. Really?
The same thing holds true with the, there's pickups that they put down below the bottom of the boat that go over the top of the live well intake. So when you're driving, it's constantly pushing water into the live well. Exact same thing happened, identical boat to my boat. The guy calls me, he says, I rigged everything the same way you did. What in the world? I'm only going 57 miles an hour and I'm getting 62. Guess what? He said, show me the picture of the back of your boat. There was that, a scupper, sure, on the back or a scoop on the back. I said, right, take that thing off. It was the day before the tournament.
Sure.
He said, it's the day before I said, take it off. He takes it off, and that morning, literally, take off is at 7. 7:03, he sends me a photo, 62.7.
Right.
So it makes a difference in what you do as well on the back of the boat.
You're talking a rocket, though. Rocket.
No, boat. I'm talking, it doesn't matter.
Rocket
If you take four miles
boat, I don't even need a high-speed transducer in mine because I can read my speed when I'm doing 35 miles an
but
hour.
But your transducer you have will read at speed.
Right.
That's the idea.
Right.
The problem you have with most boats is that creates too much turbulence and it doesn't read well at speed. Those aren't designed to be under the water or way in the water flow. And as well, you don't want that to get hit by any debris and damage that big transducer.
No, mine is like an eighth of an inch above the bottom of the boat.
Yeah, and that's a big thing.
For that reason.
And then, of course, everybody just drills into the hull. Get a plastic mounting plate.
Right.
Don't mess with drilling into the boat except the two holes for the plastic mounting bar. It's like a half inch thick. It's about 3.5 inches across and about 10 inches long. Mount it to the boat. Off to the side, not in front of the engine, and you're going to be
just
golden.
Make it level on the back of the boat, and you can put a couple of transducers on there.
You mount it with the angle of the hull,
okay,
so that you're able to mount them progressively down the hull.
Sure.
So you can mount them accordingly. If you have side imaging, it won't interfere with the other one. Right. So works well. Well, tell you what, we're going to be right back. We're going to be talking a little bit about muskies and what it takes to trigger a muskie. Stay tuned. Be right back. Thanks for hanging with us, and hang with us on some other venues as well. Where do we want to go, Don?
TheValleyOutdoors.com.
And Facebook. We'd like to have you over there as well. And lots of cool stuff on both, so check them out. And we'll get to the muskie story in a minute. I came across something that was kind of crazy. You've seen ice climbers, right?
I have.
Kind of nuts. Don't you think?
Yeah, actually, they do some of that around here.
Well, in this case, this was on Lake Superior, the story comes out of. The Coast Guard suspended a search for a missing ice climber who fell into Lake Superior from a cliff in Michigan as dangerous weather conditions hampered efforts to find the man. The 32-year-old man was climbing with a friend this last Tuesday on Pictured Rocks National Lakeshore when he fell from the cliff along the lakeshore. He said he was identified as a Gaylord, Michigan man. They received the report of the fall around 5:15 in the afternoon. They launched a response immediately, and Superior High Angle Rescue Professionals were out there looking for them. They sent an ice rescue team from the Marquette area with an MX-60 Jayhawk helicopter, and they, pretty crazy. The rescue team and helicopter continued the search, could not spot the missing man. They suspended it and said it was one of the most difficult situations they had to decide on, and they unfortunately had to suspend the search. They said the recently they also had rescued 25 people stranded on ice floes in the Great Lakes amid unsafe ice conditions, and that was water. So my statement comes and condolences to the family, but if somebody wants to go ice climbing and they're going to do it on Lake Superior, so if you misstep or do something stupid, you're going to fall into the lake.
Yeah, I don't know what the situation was, but
it was ice climbing on Lake
Superior.
There's
a lot of risk to me.
And in the mistake, this time of the year, that's the old thing, the saying, in winter, if you're out in a boat or whatever, wear your life jacket so they can find you. Well, that's all they're going to do. You've got what? I think it's like 3 to 5 minutes before.
It's a hypothermia.
Yeah, they'll just, they just want to be able to find you. But that, I will say,
I don't understand the sport. I guess there's people that are passionate about it.
Oh, but you can be passionate about it, but don't do it where you're going to end up immediately dying.
Right.
Granted, if you fall and hit the ground, you can survive at least.
Well, usually they have,
they have the
protective ropes and stuff hooked up, but evidently that wasn't the case here. So
no, sad deal. All right, Donald, here we go. You ready for the touted story on muskie?
Yeah, tell me about it.
Illinois research looks at what triggers a muskie to bite. On June 17th, in an example why muskies are considered to be the fish of 10,000 casts, a area teenager landed a 50-inch muskie. They spent nearly a year specifically targeting muskies when this particular fish was his first one. And the fish of 10,000 casts, obviously, it's notoriously elusive, making it the even bigger size fish, the one that he write home about. It's pretty cool. A new study, though, out of University of Illinois researchers got into the minds of muskie to learn what personality traits make the fish more likely to strike. In the process, they learned a valuable lesson that could help conserve the important aquatic predator. They clearly show capturing muskies is not random. There are behavioral traits that predispose the fish to being captured or caught. We need to be using best practices to try and protect those traits and keep those individuals around so we can keep fishing long term. That was the professor in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences at the University of Illinois. And they went with a graduate student, John Bieber, and they're evaluating behavioral traits such as activity, aggression, boldness, and exploration. This is the interesting part of the story, Don. You'd be very surprised. They tracked 68 young muskies in a lab tank before transferring the fish to an outdoor pond. Then what they would do is fish the pond every day for more than a month. After 35 days of throwing our whole arsenal at them, every combination of time, day, lure, casting style, we can verify that the muskies are indeed the fish of a 10,000 cast. We only caught 7 fish in that whole time.
How many did they put in there?
There were 68 muskies.
Okay.
And they fished it 35 days in a row.
Okay.
And in addition, they saw that the catch rates declined very, very rapidly after the first several days. It was a long month.
I bet it was. Tired arms.
It turns out the captured fish were larger, less exploratory, and less aggressive than their peers in laboratory behavioral tests, and that the patterns line up with muskies' overall feeding strategy. They're very tough sit-and-wait predators. That's the difficult part, which means they'll just camp out under a log or bottom of the river until something comes right by. Then they'll burst out to take the prey, and the more exploratory muskies won't strike because they're roaming around the lake trying to find shelter or get more comfortable.
Interesting.
Yeah. If you're an angler going around a lake just casting randomly, you won't necessarily mean you'll catch a muskie. You have to get your lure perfectly in the face of a muskie of the appropriate behavioral type, likely that is sedentary and poised to strike, to be able to initiate the strike. While anglers may be glad to learn it's not their fault their muskies are so hard to catch, the research deeper implications is that since fish behavior can be passed on from the parent to offspring, anglers have a vested interest in keeping large, less exploratory and aggressive fish in the population. Catch and release is key. Of course, everybody in muskie, I think, is catch and release. And then best practices, getting the fish in quickly and releasing it that minimizes impact on the fish. And they also note, researchers said that anglers in the community aren't harvesting the fish these days, but angling can be inherently stressful for fish, leading to incidental mortality. And enough of it happens to individual vulnerable to capture. They're removed from the population. Other behaviors, ones not compatible with capture, may be become dominant as muskies left behind. Makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
So why are muskies cut the fish of 10,000 casts? They hide. You have to seek. And that's the way it works. And I think that was just a crazy.
You know, it's that's one bug I have never caught is.
Don't.
Yeah. I mean, I have some friends and that I know are specific to muskie, and they spend a lot of time. And I'll tell you the one thing I really admire about them. I've never known anybody that's harvested a muskie. And, I mean, you would think in nature there would be an abundance of them because nobody ever takes any or harvests any. You know, they probably have natural death, but you would think they would be multiplying. But, I mean, we see them quite often when we're in Canada, but it's mostly accidental.
Well, like pike.
Right.
Pike, you see tons of them.
Right. You catch several of those in a trip.
And you can keep them.
Muskie, usually you pick up one or two during the trip.
Yeah, yeah. I'll tell you what, we're going to be right back. We're going to talk about a bear in Colorado that was gregarious and, I don't know, very social, I think would be the word for it. We'll be right back.
For the angler that has everything, or just thinks everything, grace your palm with the feel of a custom fishing rod made to your specs from Patriot Custom Rods. It will soon become a cherished tool in your hand, providing the sensitivity and feel you have long dreamed of. Patriot Custom Rods are specially designed to your species of fishing, rod weight, colors, grip type, and length. Treat yourself or someone else to a Patriot Custom Rod. Find us on thevalleyoutdoors.com.
Well, Don, the story kind of shocked me. I was actually laughing quite hard about the bear in Colorado Park. Bear took 400 selfies in a trap camera in the woods. They checked the park cameras, and park rangers had an amusing surprise after they checked 9 cameras across wildlife land in Boulder. Open Space and Mountain Park staff, they have cameras placed across the 46,000-acre land system for research purposes. And they discovered some bears at quite the photo shoot. One particular was featured on the trap camera. Of the 580 pictures captured, 400 photos were bear selfies of one bear.
Something attracted him to that camera.
The motion detecting cameras provide a unique opportunity to learn more about how local species use landscape around us while minimizing presence in the sensitive habitats. The cameras help park staff when recommending habitat protective measures. Cameras are simple. When the animal steps in front of the camera, the photograph is taken. This bear was captured hundreds of times, and they said the cameras are placed strategically throughout the land and in part to capture wildlife. Sometimes we put cameras in locations where we think we'll encounter fauna, beaver, or black bear. Cameras are also placed in areas where animals are typically going to pass, such as road underpasses or something similar. At night, camera uses infrared light to capture the photos without disturbing the wildlife. Hence, this particular bear had 400 photos taken. Some animal species are almost never seen by the residents of the town, and this camera does help and find out what animals are really out there and what they're up to. It's pretty funny, the number of photos. I mean, it literally, it's just, it bears face every time.
Did he smile?
Different angle. Like, hey, what about this? What about this?
You know, he must have been attracted to the click of the shutter or something that he was, were they close-up photos?
Yes.
Oh, he's right in the
he's
lens.
He's like, you know, perfect frame. Okay. I mean, he's got it figured out.
Well.
What can you say?
Well, at least they know who the bear is.
Yeah, well, they identified that one.
Yep.
They're going to probably have to move it so he's not such a ham anymore.
Right.
When is bear a ham? All right, moving right along. So every time we've talked about invasive species, it's always been generally in a derogatory.
A control thing.
Yeah. You need to be careful. Don't spread. Don't, you know, whether it's zebra mussels, it's milfoil, it's a big head carp, it's whatever. It's always pretty much, oh boy, now
how can we control it?
Right, exactly. Well, the story caught my eye. It's called The American Dream, How Invasive Species Have Created New Fisheries. And the story goes, and I've selected pieces out of this, but foreign influences in America extended into hunting and fishing cultures, and many species have been introduced from other parts of the world, and such as a feral hog, not a good thing. They spread and populated so rapidly that they forced hunters to take action against them. However, there are non-native species that have actually been embraced by the outdoor community. A great example of this would be the ringneck pheasant.
From China?
Mm-hmm. Introduced to the U.S. in 1881 from China. Since its introduction, the pheasant's become the official state bird of South Dakota and created an obsessive group of game bird hunters, Don, who specifically train dogs, buy shotguns, and come up with hunting strategies to pursue them.
Heard of that.
The idea of the non-native species having their own unique sporting cultures around them is even more prevalent in the world of fishing. Absolutely true. Across the country, plenty of foreign and displaced fishing species have been reshaping and even creating their own fisheries, and some are opening up whole new world of angling adventures. Call them happy accidents is the next section. Greatest example of foreign fish introduced entirely welcomed by anglers is the brown trout.
In Lake Michigan?
Browns were first introduced from Scotland and Germany in the 1860s with the salmonoid eggs incubated in barrels, and they were then stacked on ships across the Atlantic. They were first stocked in New York, where their aggressive nature and beautiful colors of the non-native fish were embraced by the angling community. Soon, brown trout were shipped across the country, where they were stocked in rivers, lakes, and streams from Maine to Montana, becoming the country's most iconic and sought after, especially by fly fishing. And a lot of these guys are talking about catching browns more than anything else. They like streamer fishing. These fish just crush streamers, which is kind of cool. It's a big, long-tailed fly.
Right.
And really cool.
So are most of the brown trout in the Great Lakes and tributaries, or are they?
They're all over.
They're everywhere now.
Montana, yeah.
Okay.
When they were shipped, and of course it all depends on the area and the size they get to.
Right.
As far as their habitat. So every year, a gentleman out in Montana has clients that come out to fish with him only to chase big browns. The fish are a quintessential part of fly fishing, and I don't think fly fishing in Montana would be where it is today without them. Other species introduced that may have not been welcomed by U.S. anglers but still have created entirely new fishing methods and specific techniques. No better example than the common carp.
The common carp or the
Asian
carp?
Introduced to the U.S., 1860, by Asian and European immigrants who could not believe that the vast and fruitful land had no carp swimming in it. Carp were brought to America to serve as primarily as a food fish for the growing migrant populations in California. They realized that the fish had an exceptional ability to live and reproduce in a variety of water conditions, and they started stocking carp around the country. It was looked at for a replacement to the declining native stocks of fish. Interesting. The appeal of catching carp on the fly is the first and foremost their size. They can be larger than 20 pounds on average, and they pursue carp this guy, another guy pursues him from a paddleboard, which is entertaining. We've seen guys catching walleye from a paddleboard.
Yeah, we saw him catch a lot.
He did really well. Foreign aid, when we talk about invasive species that may infiltrate a body of water, it's rarely a good thing. When you start looking at other avenues that can help counterbalance, it's kind of interesting, though. The damaging effects they may have, a great example can be found in the Great Lakes, where Pacific salmon were introduced to prey on alewives, and then the invasive species of herring were wreaking havoc on the ecology. And, of course, then what happened? They infiltrated Lake Ontario, Huron, and through the Great Lakes, and they were out competing many of the native species. And then the freshwater herring also dined on the eggs of native fish like walleye and lake trout, dropping numbers. And, well, guess what? The salmon fed heavily on the alewife, dropping the alewife population to manageable levels and making the Great Lakes one of the premier salmon fisheries in the world. So, love how the story goes. It's a great example of how everything that we have can be counteracted in a natural manner if it's done properly, but how careful we do have to be. And when there is a foreign scenario entered into the case. So presence of natural species and watersheds need to be controlled, combat their introduction and spread into lakes and rivers. So, yeah, it's one of those crazy stories. So, well, that's another week. That's a wrap, as they say. Thanks for joining us. And have fun in the outdoors, would you? It's going to be a nice week. And Don, Ava, thanks you guys for hanging with us. For me, I'm Eric. We're out of here till next week. See you, bye.